is lower, suggesting that our modern diets may have selected against carriers of this gene. Even today, when we look to less industrialized parts of the world, the theory holds water. Take the Yoruba people of Ibadan, Nigeria, whose diets have not been industrialized the way ours have. Among them, the APOE4 gene is relatively common and yet has little to no association with Alzheimer's disease when compared to African Americans. The Yoruba tend to consume less than one-third the sugar we Americans do per capita and lower glycemic index carbohydrates in general. What does this mean for you? If you carry the Alzheimer's risk gene, statistically one in four listeners of this book will, your brain may be particularly ill-suited to the post-agricultural, high-sugar, high-carbohydrate diet. By the time a person is diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, brain glucose metabolism is already reduced by 45% compared to healthy people. But as I've mentioned, any brain can experience difficulties deriving energy from glucose well before memory problems emerge. Aside from the APOE4 allele, this situation may be the result of the same diet and lifestyle stresses that encouraged the development of type 2 diabetes. In one eye-opening study, insulin resistance in the body predicted diminished glucose metabolism, called hypometabolism, in the brains of cognitively normal adults. Hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease, such as glucose hypometabolism and a loss of brain tissue, are nevertheless strongly associated with peripheral insulin resistance, wrote researchers in the journal Physiological Reviews. Revisit Chapter 4 to learn how to assess your own sensitivity to insulin. The New Frontier, Treating Alzheimer's as a Metabolic Disease. When it comes to the most common form of dementia, there are likely many interacting variables that decide one's fate. As my friend Richard Isaacson, Alzheimer's prevention specialist, says, once you've seen one case of Alzheimer's disease, you've seen one case of Alzheimer's disease. The complexity of the disease, coupled with the fact that it begins in the brain well before the appearance of symptoms, may explain why Alzheimer's drug trials have a 99.6% failure rate, and why no one has ever recovered from it. Recently, the Buck Institute for Research on Aging reported that it was able to reverse symptoms in 9 of 10 patients with varying degrees of cognitive impairment, including Alzheimer's disease. The program was designed to improve metabolic health. Blood sugar and insulin levels were reduced, and patients were told to eat low-grain diets to spur ketone production. At the same time, other factors known to play a role in metabolic health, such as nutrient deficiencies, sleep problems, and sedentary lifestyles, were addressed. In total, 36 customized interventions were prescribed to each subject, many of which are in line with the recommendations made in this book. At the end of 6 months, most patients reported improvements in their ability to think and remember, which their partners corroborated. Cognitive testing revealed an improvement as well. The report stated that some who had been unable to work due to the severity of their cognitive decline were able to resume their jobs, and brain scans even showed that one patient added new volume to the vulnerable hippocampus, a growth of nearly 10%. Does this mean that Alzheimer's disease might be reversible? While it's tempting to draw big conclusions from these few anecdotes, only a handful of patients in this trial had actual Alzheimer's disease. Therefore, to answer this question, larger controlled trials with more rigorous scientific methodology would be needed. Nonetheless, this kitchen sink approach has presented a new and worthy angle from which to tackle cognitive impairment as a metabolic problem. Taken together, it's perhaps not surprising then that a research group out of Brown University, led by neuropathologist Suzanne Delamonte, coined the term type 3 diabetes to describe Alzheimer's disease. This concept, which has since been referenced widely throughout the medical literature, directly characterizes Alzheimer's disease as being metabolic in origin. Make no mistake about it, an energy-deprived brain is bad news. In fact, the forgetfulness that we associate with typical aging may be among the first signs that the brain is struggling to fuel itself. The good news is that aside from helping to reduce oxidative stress and inflammation, providing ketones to the brain with the Genius Plan or any variant of a ketogenic diet may help the brain keep the lights on well into old age. This is because, unlike with glucose, a brain's ability to derive energy from ketones is seemingly not affected by old age, the APOE4 gene, or even Alzheimer's disease. As a bonus, ketogenic diets have even been shown to increase the number of brain mitochondria, the power plants of cells, thereby increasing metabolic efficiency, which otherwise diminishes with age and more markedly in neurological conditions. Can't I just eat my ketones? There is another means of supplying ketones to the brain that I have briefly mentioned, by consuming special ketone-generating foods. These are foods that contain a natural source of a relatively rare dietary fat called a medium-chain triglyceride, or MCT. MCTs are abundant in coconut oil, palm oil, goat's milk, and human breast milk, and they have a unique and important effect on the body. Upon consumption, these fats go straight to the liver to become converted to ketones, an astonishing property that can elevate the amount of ketones in the blood, day or night, fasted or fed. Researcher Stephen Kinane found that in a non-ketotic, non-fasted state, the brain could potentially derive 5-10% of its fuel from these supplementary ketones. Interestingly, this is the same degree of fuel lost to the hypometabolism seen in young brains with the APOE4 allele. Footnote: most fats, like the fat from olive oil or a grass-fed beef hamburger, enter the lymphatic system upon consumption, where they get disseminated throughout the body. Of the 14 grams of fat in a typical tablespoon of coconut oil, 62-70% is pure MCT, most of which is lauric acid. In breast milk, lauric acid also makes up the largest proportion of MCTs. On top of lauric acid, coconut oil contains other fatty acids including capric acid and caprylic acid, which may be even more ketogenic, particularly the latter, which is the main fatty acid advocated for use in the treatment of drug-resistant epilepsy. Often, these fatty acids are isolated to create formulations of pure MCT oil, which are nearly 100% ketone-producing medium-chain triglycerides. Frequently asked question: do ketone supplements and MCT oil help me burn fat? Answer: MCT oil and ketone supplements may provide serious cognitive benefits, but they are often marketed as a weight loss aid, for which they are not ideal. Ketones made by your body are the byproduct of fat being burned. When you add exogenous ketones, which is still a form of energy that will need to be burned, you're actually preventing your body from using its own fat. For weight loss, we think it's better and more meaningful to make your own ketones than to consume them from outside sources. For people with Alzheimer's disease or other neurodegenerative conditions, MCT oil may be particularly useful. In Alzheimer's disease, a shift in food preference occurs where sufferers develop a sweet tooth. This may be a distress call from their metabolically ailing brains, starving for energy, to attain sugar in the form of rapidly digestible carbohydrates, the exact kinds of foods that spike insulin, drive inflammation, and block ketone production. Supplementary coconut or MCT oil theoretically may circumvent this particular issue, while dietary carbohydrates are gradually lowered. When these dietary ketones are given to sufferers of memory loss, cognition has improved in some studies, and at least one case report has detailed positive responses from a patient with advanced Alzheimer's who consumed as little as 2 tablespoons per day. You can even get a prescription for a medical food made from caprylic acid, which is FDA approved for the treatment of Alzheimer's disease. Its use as a preventative strategy for Alzheimer's is currently being studied. Mary Newport, a coconut oil pioneer. I became familiar with Mary Newport's work with coconut oil early on. Her husband Steve was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease and became unable to perform many of his daily activities, including some of his favorite pastimes. After trying all available pharmaceutical options without much luck, Mary set out to look for something better. She stumbled upon a press release for a medical food being developed that was composed of caprylic acid, an MCT. The press release claimed that by supplying ketones to the brain, it improved memory and cognition in nearly half the Alzheimer's patients tested. With the disease now 7 years advanced and quickly ravaging her husband's brain, Mary was desperate to get her hands on this experimental product. But FDA approval would not happen for another year. That's when she had a revelation. Mary Newport happens to be a physician in neonatology, a subspecialty of pediatrics that consists of the medical care of newborn infants. She was already familiar with MCTs because they are a component of breast milk and were commonly used in the 70s and 80s to help very premature newborns gain weight. Since then, MCT and coconut oil have been added to virtually all infant formulas. Mary's unique training taught her that she might simply be able to give her husband coconut oil instead of waiting for the medical formulation to make it to market. Mary began giving Steve just over 2 tablespoons of coconut oil a day, calculated to the equivalent amount of MCTs in a dose of the medical food, and then administered a clock drawing test, which is sometimes used to assess cognitive function. Anyone with a loved one with dementia will be all too familiar with this test. After just 2 weeks on daily doses of coconut oil, Steve's clock drawing improved dramatically. Soon, Mary began cooking with it and giving it to Steve any chance she could. By the 5th week, Steve's clock was night and day better than on the first day. Refer to the PDF enhancement to see the clock drawing test progress. Over the following year, Mary gradually increased Steve's dose up to 11 tablespoons of coconut oil combined with MCT oil per day. Increasing the dosage of MCT oil too rapidly can cause diarrhea. According to Mary's reports, Steve's memory improved, as did his scores on cognitive tests. He regained many of his abilities to perform daily tasks, going back in time at least 2 to 3 years in his disease process, says Mary. On 2 days that Steve missed his dose, she recalls a marked regression in his abilities, a sign that the coconut oil may have been responsible for Steve's improvement. She continued to give Steve coconut oil for nearly a decade and implemented diet and lifestyle changes similar to those I recommend in this book. Mary's coconut oil experiment, which has since been published as a case study in the journal Alzheimer's and Dementia, began 7 years into her husband's disease, which we now know had actually started in Steve's brain decades prior. Ultimately, Steve lost his battle with Alzheimer's disease and passed away in 2015, but his story continues to live on in Mary's advocacy. For those who are cognitively healthy and accustomed to a high carbohydrate diet, MCT oils and fats might also help supplement brain energy while you reduce your carbohydrate load, but this is currently just informed speculation. For many adopting a lower-carb diet for the first time, the low-carb flu can be a common occurrence for the first few days, characterized by feelings of lethargy, brain fog, and irritability. So anything with the potential to help give your brain a boost and push you through this period would be worthwhile. There's certainly no harm in trying, and some of the brain benefits of ketones may still be attained by including these oils in your diet as you reduce your dependence on glucose. Feel free to experiment, just be advised that it hasn't really been tested yet. And don't forget to add salt, which I mentioned earlier. While you may be thinking that MCT oil would be the perfect topping for a serving of pasta or added to your morning bowl of cereal, who wouldn't want to have their cake and eat it too, forcing an elevation of ketones in the context of a high carbohydrate diet ignores many of the underlying problems driving neurodegeneration and brain aging to begin with, that is, excessive insulin. Equally important, the transient ketones from a supplement will never reach the concentrations achieved during a ketogenic diet or period of fasting. Supplementing with coconut oil or even with commercially available pure MCT oil in a non-fasted state is the equivalent of pouring water into an already full cup. Fasting or eating a low-carb diet, thereby allowing your body to generate its own ketones, is akin to drinking from that cup instead. Remember, biochemical liposuction, when your body is able to tap into its own fat stores and use those fats for energy, occurs when you drop your insulin sufficiently, not because you've added more fat into your diet. In healthy adults, ketones are simply a marker of all the other wonderful processes that go along with fasting that we've already mentioned. When you're burning your own fat, adding oil contributes calories, which is fine, but keep in mind that a dramatic surplus of calories, whether from carbs, protein, or fat, can eventually cause you to gain weight. In modern times, many of us have gone most of our lives without our brains adapting to using our own fat as fuel, because we're always eating. Give your body and brain a chance to burn that fat, and your biology will repay you in spades. Up next, a forgotten organ hidden within you and its powerful role in the healthy performance of your brain. Field notes. Ketones are considered a superfuel, capable of reducing oxidative stress in the brain and upregulating genes involved in neuroplasticity. Certain brains are unable to use glucose effectively, and ketones may provide an alternate fuel source. A common misconception is that ketones are created as the result of eating more fat. In actuality, ketones are generated when insulin is reduced, which is the result of fasting or a low-carbohydrate diet. Metabolic flexibility is a greater goal than chronic ketosis, unless treating a neurological condition whereby medical ketosis may be warranted. With metabolic flexibility, we can enjoy dalliances with ketosis while also nurturing gut health and enjoying the occasional carbohydrate fuel-up to sustain physical performance. This won't interrupt the fat-adapted state. Raising ketones with MCT oil while consuming excessive carbohydrates defeats the purpose and ignores many of the underlying problems driving neurodegeneration. Genius food number 6, grass-fed beef. The meat industry as it currently stands is cruel, unsustainable, and frankly, indefensible. In the case of beef, the industry produces meat that is unhealthy, from stressed-out animals that are pumped full of antibiotics and fed a highly unnatural diet of throwaway grains and even candy. Footnote, you heard that correctly. Feedlot animals are routinely fed junk food like candy, cookies, and marshmallows because those foods provide cheap carbs to fatten them up. But let's not conflate factory-farmed beef with the beef that comes from healthy cows that have been allowed to pasture on grass, their natural diet, experiencing, as their farmers like to say, only one bad day. Much of the debate surrounding the nutritional value of meat centers on protein, but I believe it's critical to broaden the conversation to nutrients other than protein that play an important role in our cognitive function. For example, grass-fed beef is a rich source of essential minerals like iron and zinc, where they are packaged in a form that the body can easily utilize. This is unlike, say, the iron from spinach or zinc from legumes. Grass-fed beef is also a great source of omega-3 fats, vitamin B12, vitamin E, and even certain nutrients, such as creatine, covered earlier, which, though not essential, are highly beneficial. Researchers believe that it was access to these very nutrients, along with the burst of caloric energy from cooked meat, that catalyzed the evolution of our brains into modern cognitive supermachines. Deficiencies in any of these micronutrients are linked with brain-related disorders including low IQ, autism, depression, and dementia. Few know the link between diet and mental health better than Dr. Felice Jacka, director of Deakin University's Food and Mood Center, and someone whom I've had the privilege of interviewing. In 2017, she published the world's first randomized control trial showing the antidepressant effect of healthy food. I detail her findings in Chapter 8. Previously, she found that women who didn't eat Australia's national recommendation of 3 to 4 servings of beef per week were twice as likely to be depressed or suffer from an anxiety or bipolar disorder as those who did. She also found that while some was better than none, more wasn't necessarily better. Women who consumed more than the recommended amount were also at increased risk. In Australia, cows tend to be grass-fed by default, an important caveat. What about the value of meat to the cognitive function of a particularly vulnerable group, children? Far from the reach of food delivery apps, malnourishment still poses a public health problem in various parts of the world. One of these places is Kenya, where Charlotte Newman, a researcher at UCLA's Fielding School of Public Health, observed that children who consume more meat actually tend to perform better, physically, cognitively, and behaviorally. To see what effect, if any, meat consumption might have on the developing brain, Dr. Newman designed a trial. She divided children from 12 Kenyan schools into 4 groups. One group served as the control, while children in the other 3 groups each received a porridge made up of corn, beans, and greens every morning for breakfast. One group received the mixture with a glass of milk. Another had ground beef added, and the third just got the plain Jane version. All versions were balanced to contain the same number of calories, and the study ran for 2 years. Compared with the other groups, students in the meat group gained more muscle mass and had fewer health problems than the children who consumed the porridge plain or with milk. They also showed greater confidence in the playground, a sign of improved mental health. Cognitive performance was stronger too. While all groups improved, the meat group showed the steepest rate of improvement in math and language subjects. Newman and her colleagues wrote, "The improved cognitive performance and increased physical activity and leadership and initiative behaviors in the meat group may be linked to greater intake of vitamin B12 and more available iron and zinc as a result of the presence of meat, which increases iron and zinc absorption from fiber and phytate-rich plant staples. Meat, through its intrinsic micronutrient content and other constituents in high-quality protein, may facilitate specific mechanisms such as speed of information processing that are involved in learning." This study was performed in children, but we now know that our brains continue to change throughout life. Supplying them with the nutrients they need should be top priority. Still, many will write off all meat as unhealthy. But to this I say, quoting Carl Sagan, "Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Meat and the nutrients it contains were an essential part of the evolution of our brains, with evidence of butchery by early humans dating back more than 3 million years. Today, we have the luxury of getting to choose our meals based on ethics, but our forebears had no such privilege. They would not have passed up the opportunity for the life-sustaining nutrients contained in fresh meat. The notion that properly raised animals providing a bevy of highly bioavailable nutrients are somehow bad for us would be an extraordinary claim with little good evidence to back it up. While I'll never know if my mom's lifelong abstinence from red meat had anything to do with her memory loss or the bouts of depression she would occasionally suffer during my childhood, it's clear that it hadn't protected her either. How to buy. Look for humanely raised 100% grass-fed and grass-finished beef, ideally organic and from local farms. Note that organic beef, unless it clearly states 100% grass-fed, is usually from cows fed organic grain. Pro tip. Ground grass-fed beef tends to be much more economical than chops. If access to grass-fed beef is difficult, mail order subscription services are a great alternative. You can find some recommendations at maxl.ug/gfresources. How to cook. While grass-fed beef has triple the vitamin E of grain-fed beef, which helps protect its polyunsaturated fats from oxidation, I recommend using as low a heat as possible. Consider cooking with garlic and onion-based marinades to reduce the formation of neurotoxic compounds like heterocyclic amines. Always pair with fibrous veggies such as kale, spinach, or Brussels sprouts, which help to neutralize oxidative products in the gut, and avoid consuming with starchy vegetables, grains, and other concentrated carbs. Bonus points. Eat organ meats and drink bone broth. Both are full of important nutrients not contained in muscle meat, such as collagen. Collagen contains important amino acids, which too have become lost to the modern diet. One of them, glycine, has been shown to improve sleep quality and may increase brain levels of serotonin, important for healthy mood and executive function. Chapter 7. Go with your gut. If you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. African proverb. We humans have known since time immemorial something that science is only now discovering. Our gut feeling is responsible in no small measure for how we feel. We are scared shitless, or we can be shitting ourselves with fear. If we don't manage to complete a job, we can't get our ass in gear. We swallow our disappointment and need time to digest a defeat. A nasty comment leaves a bad taste in our mouth. When we fall in love, we get butterflies in our stomach. Julia Enders, Gut. If you're like most people, the thought of a collection of trillions of bacterial cells living inside of you may be enough to make you want to run for the closest shower. The implicit ick factor is compounded by the fact that we live in a culture that seizes every opportunity to sell us antibacterial soaps and sanitizers. But the truth is, we've been sold a lie about bacteria. Without them, we wouldn't be here. You're now familiar with mitochondria, the cellular organelles responsible for combining glucose, or ketones, a byproduct of fat metabolism, with oxygen to create energy. These important structures didn't always work for us. As the theory goes, there were once bacteria floating about the world, when one mitochondrion became engulfed by another bacterium. Rather than digest it, the much larger host cell was able to exploit its new friend's energy-producing capabilities for survival, a serious advantage 1.5 billion years ago as the world was becoming increasingly oxygenated. In return, the mitochondrion got protection from the elements and an unlimited all-you-can-eat buffet. But they could never, ever leave. It was perhaps the earliest ever case of Stockholm Syndrome. Over time, the mitochondrion and its host cell began to depend on each other, joining the ranks of famous partnerships like Batman and Robin, Han Solo and Chewbacca, and Bert and Ernie. Well, maybe not quite like Bert and Ernie. This was the birth of the complex eukaryotic cells that ultimately gave rise to multicellular organisms like us. Even after all these years, it's striking to realize that our mitochondria can still multiply inside our cells and hold on to their own, completely separate set of DNA, a throwback to their lives as bachelorettes. We would be nowhere without bacteria, and though our modern form is vastly more complex than in those early years as single-celled organisms, our communion with bacteria today is no less important. There are countless microbes on our skin, around our ears, in our hair, in our mouths, on our genitals, and in our guts. Even parts of ourselves once thought to be sterile, like the lungs and the mammary glands of the breasts, are now known to be posh country clubs for microbes. Each location has its own population that lives in symbiosis with its unique environment. The gut microbe population, for example, which consists primarily of bacteria that live without oxygen, would die instantly if placed next to the microbes on your face, which delight in their exposure to fresh air. The general term that we use for the cumulative genetic content of all these simple, single-celled organisms is the microbiome. Your house has its own microbiome, which represents the genetic material carried by the microbes that live in it. Your home microbiome may differ dramatically from your neighbor's, depending on whether you have a dog or a small child, and whether you live in a city or in a suburb. Even entire cities have their own microbial signatures. The microbiome of Los Angeles, for example, is different from that of New York. Do West Coast bacteria prefer on-camera work to the stage where the East Coast microbes really shine? These questions remain to be answered by science. Though you have microbes all over the exterior of your body, the vast majority of microbial cells that you carry with you reside in your gut. This is your gut microbiome. Though we once believed they outnumbered our own human cells 10 to 1, we've since arrived at a more accurate estimate, about 30 trillion, placing their population roughly at the same number of cells that contain human DNA. No less impressive, however, is that the weight of these bacteria alone equals the weight of your brain, somewhere between 2 and 3 pounds. What's in your poop? The average stool sample is more than half bacteria, with each gram consisting of 100 billion microbes. That's nearly 14 times the global human population in just 1 gram of dookie. Fecal matter is so dense with microbes, in fact, that every time you go to the bathroom, you excrete about 1/3 of your colonic bacterial content. Not to worry, however, as the colonic bacterial count rebuilds over the course of the day. These microbes contain lots of information, each carrying their own unique genetic material. If we consider the total amount of genetic material represented by our bacterial friends, whose DNA length is typically 1 to 10 megabases, which holds 1 million bytes of information, just 1 gram of human stool has a data capacity of 100,000 terabytes. And you thought your thumb drive keychain was cool. Much like we outsource aspects of our cognition to our smartphones, the ability to remember phone numbers, for example, freeing up our brain power for other tasks, we outsource many services to our microbiome. It's able to provide these services in part because it represents genetic material nearly 100 times as complex as our own relatively rudimentary genome of 23,000 genes. This makes the microbiome capable of a wide range of functions, from keeping our immune systems healthy, to extracting calories from food, to synthesizing important chemicals, like vitamins. It might not seem obvious, but the gut and brain have a very close relationship as well. Our microbiome is connected to our moods and behavior, communicating with our brain through the vagus nerve, which provides a direct line between brain and gut, as well as through the various chemicals it produces and releases into our bloodstream. The rent paid by our bacterial immigrant population is so underappreciated, it's no wonder scientists are now referring to this writhing mass of genetic material as our forgotten organ. MTV Cribs, Microbiome Edition. Though we'd rather not think of ourselves as elaborate digestive tubes with legs, that's essentially what we are. Nearly every feature of our being has evolved to help us better procure energy in the form of food. The gut, the term given to this long and windy tube, also known as the alimentary canal, begins at the mouth and ends, well, you know where. Gut health and function are not usually an easy topic for people to talk about. After all, our gut makes strange noises, is a source of physical discomfort for many, and excretes things that I'm betting most would prefer not to even think about. The gut also mediates our relationship with food, which can become distorted and deranged when we are dealing with weight problems. A journey south, beginning at the mouth and traveling down the esophagus, first reveals the stomach, followed by the small intestine, and finally the large intestine, otherwise known as the colon. Each of these segments has its own unique climate, just as you might experience when traveling from the northeast of the United States down to the sunny beaches of South Florida. As you venture farther south, you notice a difference in vegetation, foliage, birds, and insects, all naturally selected for adeptness according to temperature, local cuisine, seasonal variation, and countless other variables unique to each location. Similarly, the gastrointestinal tract has a different climate the farther down one travels, and microbes know this. The stomach is too acidic for microbiota to reside unless you regularly take an acid-blocking medication like millions of Americans do, which can cause many unintended and unpredictable consequences. And the small intestine, as an active site of nutrient absorption, is too volatile. There are still microbes this early in our journey. Per gram of content in the stomach and small intestine, there are roughly 1,000 to 100 million bacteria. Though they are innocuous in these quantities, problems can arise when bacteria overpopulate here. In the small intestine, SIBO, or small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, can cause bloating, abdominal pain, and even nutrient deficiencies for the host. Once we get down to the colon, however, it provides the most suitable atmosphere for these bacteria, and the concentration of microbes there shoots up to 100 billion bacteria per gram. It's the Miami of the GI tract. Part of the reason these bacteria are so high in number in the large intestine is that that's where your tenants can expect to find an abundant source of sustenance. You see, the gut microbiome is composed of a kind of bacteria called commensals, which comes from the Latin word commensalis, meaning sharing a table. They've earned this name because every time we eat, they wait silently to be fed, like 30 trillion obedient dogs. But what do they eat? Thrown into a modern restaurant, commensal bacteria would skip the menu entirely and head straight for the salad bar. It's there that these little critters would find the food that they love to chow down on, plant fibers. These fibers provide a form of carbohydrate that is inaccessible to us and passes through the stomach and small intestine undigested. When those fibers finally make it down to the large intestine, the microbes get to experience the equivalent of a Thanksgiving dinner. Meat and the microbiome. A study published a couple of years ago sent shockwaves down the spine of many a health-conscious meat eater. Researchers studying mice found that some species of gut bacteria consume the amino acid carnitine found in red meat, which in turn elevates a compound called trimethylamine N-oxide, or TMAO. TMAO is thought to contribute to atherosclerosis, the disease process that leads to plaque-ridden arteries. The ensuing fear was that meat, independent of its saturated fat or any of the other health claims previously waged against it, might now promote heart disease via an entirely new mechanism, microbial fermentation. Closer inspection into the research reveals a few important details. First, the mice were fed very high doses of supplemental carnitine. This caused a shift in the microbiome and gave these TMAO-producing bacteria a competitive edge in the large intestine. Second, low-grain vegan and vegetarian diets appear to select against carnitine-loving gut flora, a fact highlighted by microbiome researcher Jeff Leach. In the human arm of the study, researchers were able to convince a vegan to consume an 8-ounce steak to see what it would do to her TMAO levels, and they didn't budge. Though a small N-of-1 experiment, the results suggest that, to a certain point, the overall composition of the microbiome is more important than the individual food being consumed. A reasonable takeaway? Don't give meat a TMAO out, just eat mostly vegetables and skip the grains. Forced to adopt the modern diet, the host-microbe relationship can become strained. As I mentioned, they only really like to consume one thing, fiber. Specifically, a form of fiber called prebiotic fiber. This includes soluble fiber and a form of indigestible starch called resistant starch. Offer your standard American breakfast of refined flour pancakes, bacon, and cheesy eggs, and your typical intestinal bacterium would politely decline. Now, you may want to write off your microbe friends for being too picky when it comes to dining plans, but keep in mind that for hundreds of thousands of years, humans ate diets that were rich in fiber, with scientists estimating an intake of roughly 150 grams of fiber per day. Today, we consume just 15 grams per day on average. Much like our inadequate consumption of omega-3s and other essential nutrients, prebiotic fibers have been largely stripped from our Western dietary pattern. The disappearance of these microbiota-accessible carbohydrates, a term coined by prominent Stanford University microbiologists Justin and Erica Sonnenberg, presents serious downstream health consequences, as you'll learn. But increasing the presence of these gut-happy carbs is easy, as there are plenty of foods full of prebiotic fiber. These include berries, leeks, jicama, kale, sunchokes, avocado, spinach, arugula, garlic, onions, coffee, chicory root, unripe bananas, raw nuts, fennel, okra, bell peppers, broccoli, radishes, dark chocolate, and sprouts. Now that you know where to find these nourishing fibers, the next section will close the loop, definitively linking them to improved mood, cognition, and longevity. A fountain of youth. Unless you're a Turritopsis dohrnii, aging well is likely a concern for you. If you're one of these newly discovered immortal jellyfish lazing about the Mediterranean Sea, you possess the ability to regress to earlier stages of development at will. If you're not one of these lucky creatures, however, you'll likely want to preserve mind and body for as long as possible. One result of fiber consumption is that our microbial friends metabolize the fiber and transform it into chemicals called short-chain fatty acids, or SCFAs. This category of fatty acids includes butyrate, acetate, and propionate, all of which have been linked to many longevity and health-promoting effects. These fatty acids are the literal waste products of bacteria, and yet we are indebted to them for it. The most extensively studied of the SCFAs is called butyrate. Grass-fed beef and dairy contain small amounts of this fat, but a much more appreciable amount of butyrate is churned out by our microbiota when we simply eat more fiber. This is desirable partly because butyrate has been shown to raise levels of BDNF, which directly promotes neuroplasticity and slows neurodegenerative processes. Aside from increasing BDNF, the brain's anti-aging miracle grow, one of butyrate's most beneficial effects is in reducing inflammation. Generally speaking, the more fiber you consume, the more closely your microbiota begin to resemble an inflammation-extinguishing butyrate factory. In terms of your cognitive function, less inflammation means that you can think more clearly and focus and remember things better. But while taking steps to reduce inflammation is key for thinking and performing at your best, doing so may also guard you against the march of time. When it comes to longevity, the important thing to focus on is your health span. Unlike your lifespan, which describes the number of years in your life, your health span represents the amount of life in your years. Having a longer health span means less disability, better cognitive function, better mood, and being free of chronic disease for as long as possible. Ideally, we'd like long lifespans and health spans to match. Unfortunately, today, our lifespans are increasing thanks in part to the wonders of modern medicine, but our health spans are not. We're simply living sick longer. But there are some exceptions to this. People who seem to stay vibrant and healthy up until the very end of their lives. In one study that followed more than 1,600 adults for an entire decade, those who ate the most fiber were 80% more likely to be free of hypertension, diabetes, dementia, depression, and disability than low-fiber consumers. In fact, fiber consumption determined healthy aging more than any other variable studied, including sugar intake. Not bad for a nutrient most famous for helping our grandparents more easily go to the bathroom. And that's not the end of it. Fecal microbiota transplantation, or FMT. Although the transplantation of fecal material from one person to another may not be pleasant to think about, imagine for a second you had an infection called C. difficile, a pathogenic and antibiotic-resistant bacteria that causes profound diarrhea and intestinal inflammation. Clostridium difficile results in 500,000 hospitalizations and 30,000 deaths annually, according to the latest estimates from the CDC. Highly opportunistic, C. difficile is contagious and already present in 2-5% of the human adult population. Antibiotic use is a major risk factor for C. difficile because these drugs decimate healthy gut populations, allowing the pathogen to exploit weaknesses in the microbial community until it becomes a full-blown infection. In 2013, scientists wanted to see if transplanting the microbiome of a healthy person into one with such an infection could reestablish order and help defeat C. difficile naturally. Performed via fecal microbiota transplant, or FMT, where the bacteria-rich stool of a healthy person is transplanted into the GI tract of a sick person, the procedure was found to be more than 90% successful, an astonishing and unprecedented cure rate. The procedure typically requires invasive and uncomfortable colonoscopies, enemas, and even nasal tubes to deliver the healthy stool. However, researchers have recently refined the delivery method to frozen pills and have found them to be just as safe and effective as traditional transplant techniques. Oh, the sweet smell of progress. The immune tuner. Autoimmunity, when a person's immune system attacks parts of their own body, is the defining feature of many common diseases, including celiac disease, MS, type 1 diabetes, and Hashimoto's disease, to name a few. Why does autoimmunity develop, and why is it seemingly on the rise? Are we meant to have immune systems that harm our bodies and brains in acts of friendly fire? Or is this one more aspect of our biology succumbing to the pitfalls of modern life? To understand how our diets and lifestyles may contribute to a confused immune system and thus autoimmunity, it helps to understand how this dynamic system is trained throughout your life. If you were to picture a cross-section of a tunnel, you'd get a pretty good sense of the anatomy of the large intestine. The innermost tissue is the epithelium. This one cell layer thick barrier acts as the division between the interior of your colon, known as the lumen, and your circulation. Because its contents are not part of your body, similar to the air that fills your lungs, the lumen is actually thought of by scientists as being part of the host's environment. In fact, the gut is actually your largest interface with the environment, much larger than your skin. If you were to remove your entire digestive tube from your body, uncoil it, and sprawl it out on the ground, it would take up the square footage of a small studio apartment. For this reason, the vast majority of our body's immune cells are primed to focus on what's happening in our digestive systems. Though this may seem counterintuitive or even a misuse of resources in today's world of packaged foods and triple-washed produce, it makes sense. For the vast majority of our time on Earth, well before any semblance of a modern food system, our food was dirty. We didn't have supermarkets full of the freshest and most attractive produce at our convenience, and we certainly didn't co-evolve with the plethora of antibacterial soaps or vegetable washes available today, promising hospital-grade sterility to our every last bite. For our Paleolithic ancestors, the potential for swallowing a pathogen, a microbe that could infect and possibly kill us, was great. This put immense pressure on our species early on to ensure that we could mount an agile and formidable immune response should such a confrontation occur. But our intestines are loaded with outside bugs. Is there a war raging in our bellies that we aren't privy to? Not quite. A healthy immune system must work like the highly trained security personnel at a sports arena, deftly surveying thousands of ticket-holding attendees without breaking a sweat. These guards don't question every quirky-looking stadium visitor they see. When they're well-trained, they can spot signs far in advance if a person is likely to step out of line. Like the visitors at a stadium, our microbial residents hone our guards' skills, helping them adapt to the constantly changing environment, so that when an unfriendly visitor does come along, it can be easily spotted. Our gut and its inhabitants therefore serves as a sort of training camp for our body's immune system. When our immune system is not up to par, it not only becomes less effective at spotting invaders, but sometimes mistakenly attacks the body's own cells. This is because a diverse gut population not only teaches our immune system guards who to watch out for, it also teaches them the importance of tolerance. In a healthy gut, there may be hundreds or thousands of different species present at any given time, and a healthy immune system benefits from this plurality of voices. In fact, this is partly how probiotics are believed to work. They consist of species that aren't normally resident in our microbiomes, flowing through us to make sure our guards aren't snoozing on the job. Issues like allergies and autoimmunity develop when the immune system makes a mistake and attacks its own host, and the microbiome has become a focal point for scientists working to figure out why this happens. It has been proposed that our immune systems have become dysfunctional for a number of reasons, including our overly hygienic lives, antibiotic overuse, fiber inadequacy, and birthing practices that place the developing microbiome as an afterthought. Any one of these factors, it is believed, may lead to stadium guards that aren't well trained, and thus to higher rates of autoimmunity. Cleaning ourselves sick? Something other than our food supply has changed over the past couple of decades. We've become more sterile. But in our preoccupation with eliminating any possibility of a stray virus or pathogenic bacteria, we've essentially wiped clean many of the more positive interactions that we would have had with rogue bacteria. Such interactions help to train the adaptive immune system, which, after all, was shaped by natural selection under just these circumstances. Research shows that while exposure to pathogens and the rate of infections has decreased, rates of both autoimmune and allergic diseases have increased. The idea that these two statistics are causally linked is the basis for the hygiene hypothesis. The theory is this: some infectious agents, notably those that co-evolved with us, protect us from immune-related disorders. Today, the absence of these pathogens results in weakened immune systems, leaving them vulnerable to confusion and setting the stage for type 1 diabetes, multiple sclerosis, celiac disease, and others. With diabetes, obesity, and even Alzheimer's disease all characterized by chronically heightened inflammation, aka an immune system gone awry, it isn't a leap to suggest that our overly sterile lives may be to blame here as well. In fact, recent research has explored the very link between national hygiene and Alzheimer's disease incidence. Using public sanitation and access to clean drinking water as metrics, researchers revealed a striking relationship. Countries with greater levels of hygiene had increased incidence of Alzheimer's disease in a perfect linear correlation. Gluten provides the perfect illustration of how a confused immune system could lead to an autoimmune response, as it does for a significant portion of the population. Gliadin, one of the main proteins in gluten, looks a lot like a microbe to our immune cells. When it is present in the gut, our immune system sends out antibodies in a manhunt for antigens, physical attributes that our stadium security guards are trained to look out for. The problem is, antigens on foreign substances, like gliadin, can look uncomfortably similar to the markings on our own cells. This is called molecular mimicry, and may be an attempt by pathogens to better fit into the host environment, because even pathogens have a drive to survive. This means that when the body's immune system creates antibodies to fight antigens, our own tissues can fall under friendly fire. This can often occur to a family of enzymes called transglutaminases. Present throughout the body, transglutaminases are important for keeping us healthy, and their dysfunction has been implicated in Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, and ALS. They're also found in particularly high concentration in the thyroid, which gets attacked in autoimmune thyroid conditions like Hashimoto's disease and Graves' disease, Unfortunately, transglutaminase enzymes have molecular markings very similar to gliadin antigens. In a susceptible person, eating gluten may lead the body to attack not only gliadin, but also the transglutaminase enzymes. While it can't be said that gluten is the cause of a mutinous immune system for every person, a recent study found the prevalence of celiac disease in patients with autoimmune thyroid disease was 2- to 5-fold compared to healthy controls. In fact, other autoimmune conditions, including type 1 diabetes and multiple sclerosis, occur together with celiac disease more frequently than with any other autoimmune condition, suggesting that an unhealthy gut is a mediator of this wide range of seemingly unconnected diseases. Any one of these conditions may be a sign that the brain is under threat of attack. People who have autoimmune disorders are more likely to develop dementia, recent research shows. Keep in mind that these diseases manifest after many months or years, often without obvious symptoms. And for many patients with overlapping thyroid and celiac disease, gastrointestinal symptoms are absent, marking one of the rare instances where going with your gut may lead you astray. Preventing or halting this immune breakdown is not achieved simply by going on a gluten-free diet. It's important to add something back to the diet that is sorely missing from our modern plates, fiber. Fiber directly protects us against immune confusion, in part because short-chain fatty acids like butyrate increase the production and development of regulatory T cells in the colon. These cells, also called Tregs, are a type of immune cell that helps ensure a healthy and appropriate inflammatory response by suppressing the responses of other immune cells, including those that promote inflammation. Think of them as the managers on the security force that keep the more pugnacious junior guards under control. They are key players in helping your body better distinguish between itself and everything else. If that critical ability breaks down, your immune system might end up attacking your own body. And voila, autoimmunity develops. Protecting our brains from what's in our guts. As I've mentioned earlier, the colon is where the majority of bacteria in your gastrointestinal tract reside, giving the cells that line it two important functions, serving as a blockade against pathogens and bacteria that don't belong in your circulation, while also allowing for the absorption of fluids and any remaining nutrients that haven't been absorbed by the small intestine. This physical barrier forms part of the body's innate immune system. The innate immune system plays a major role in mediating inflammation and autoimmunity. It helps keep the microbiome and our immune cells, our adaptive immune system, separate from each other, regulating host-microbial interactions and maintaining appropriate immune functions on a constant basis. In our stadium metaphor, this allows the game to go on as planned, ensuring a nice day for everyone there. The guards can safely perform their jobs, the fans can eat their hot dogs and cheer for their respective teams, and the players can compete, allowing them to earn millions of dollars in endorsement money. Physical barriers help make all this possible. The cells of the epithelium, your intestinal lining, are held together by tight junctions that can open and close like the drawbridge on a castle. Thankfully, they are closed most of the time. However, exposure to potentially dangerous bacteria, especially in the small intestine, can cause the junctions to loosen, drawing water and immune cells into the gut lumen. This usually results in diarrhea to flush out the troublemaker, a critical defense response during acute infection. Unfortunately, certain aspects of modern life can also cause our gut barrier to be more porous and allow for retrograde transport, or the transport of gut contents deep into the gut lining. This leads to considerable consequences and possibly initiates the molecular mimicry that is thought to result in autoimmunity. One possible instigator of undue permeability to the gut lining is gluten, the protein found in wheat, rye, barley, and many packaged foods. Gluten is unique among proteins that we consume because, unlike, say, the protein we get from eating a chicken breast, gluten is not completely digested by humans. Protein from most sources will separate into its constituent amino acids during digestion, but gluten breaks down only into large fragments called peptides. These fragments have been found to stimulate a more permeable gut in humans, triggering a welcoming from the innate immune system more similar to that of a bacterial invader than that of your usual dietary protein. At the center of this response is another protein called zonulin, which is produced in the gut whenever gluten is present. Zonulin acts as a cellular gatekeeper of sorts, regulating the integrity of the tight junctions in between epithelial cells. Where there is zonulin, there is permeability. Dr. Alessio Fasano, founder of Mass General's Center for Celiac Research and an internationally recognized expert in celiac disease, is credited with having discovered this important mediator of gut permeability. This hyperpermeability can occur in anyone, but is exaggerated in those with celiac disease. For this population, gluten evokes an overt autoimmune response, causing the lining of the small intestine to become damaged over time. One of the dangers of a more permeable gut is that it allows bacterial endotoxin, also known as lipopolysaccharide, or LPS, to cross over into circulation. As I've mentioned in previous chapters, LPS is a molecule that makes up part of the membrane of certain bacteria that normally live within the safe harbor of our large intestine. When leaked into circulation, endotoxin sets off an acute pro-inflammatory response, signaling a systemic bacterial invasion. LPS exposure is directly related to pro-inflammatory cytokine production and an increase in oxidative stress, wreaking havoc on a wide range of bodily systems, including your brain. When animals are inflamed, usually from infection, they exhibit strange behavioral changes, displaying symptoms of lethargy, depression, anxiety, and reduced grooming. They retract from the herd and become more sedentary, a means of reserving the body's energy for healing and isolating them from the healthy. This is not a phenomenon exclusive to farm animals. Humans react similarly. They become irritable, lose interest in food and socializing, and have trouble focusing and even remembering recent events. These are called sickness behaviors, and it's a phenomenon well known to farmers, zookeepers, and scientists. Psychologists believe this to be a motivational state, an adaptive strategy on the part of our biology to aid in survival. Major depression may be an extreme form of sickness behavior. Depression is well known to be more common in those with inflammatory conditions like heart disease, arthritis, diabetes, and cancer. On the surface, these conditions have nothing to do with the brain, but the volume of inflammatory markers in the blood and the risk for depression correlate in lockstep. The higher the levels of these markers, the more severe the depression. This groundbreaking new view of depression, a condition affecting more than 350 million people globally, has challenged the pre-existing paradigm for treatment and given rise to a whole new theory of its origin, the inflammatory cytokine model of depression. And what is often injected to induce such a state in lab animals by scientists studying depression and other consequences of inflammation? Bacterial LPS. Zonulin, the protein that triggers increased permeability, is also capable of altering the tight junctions at the blood-brain barrier, which is another layer of specialized epithelial cells. This is significant because the breakdown of the blood-brain barrier has been implicated early on in the development of Alzheimer's disease. Not surprisingly, a gluten-free diet reduces both zonulin levels and gut permeability and may maintain the brain's protective barrier as well. So, if you don't have celiac disease or a wheat allergy, might cutting wheat out of your diet help your brain work better? Researchers at Columbia University recently asked this very question and studied patients who did not have celiac disease or a confirmed traditional wheat allergy. However, they did have symptoms such as fatigue and cognitive difficulties after eating wheat. The researchers placed the subjects on a wheat, rye, and barley-free diet, and after 6 months, signs of immune activation and intestinal cell damage had disappeared. This was associated with significant improvement in both gastrointestinal symptoms and cognitive function, as reported by the patients via detailed questionnaires. While the medical community has been debating and disputing the very existence of wheat sensitivity, This exciting research is among the first to validate non-celiac wheat reactivity with objective measurements. How do probiotics work? Though it may seem like probiotic drinks, supplements, and even probiotic-infused foods are all the rage today, probiotics are by no means a new phenomenon. We've been fermenting foods and harnessing